From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on October 2nd, 2024, from the side of a road in Greenville outside of the airport. Yes, it's been a long day, folks. We're sorry this pod is late. But on this episode of The Lead, we start with a brief look at the ongoing recovery efforts from Tropical Storm Helene and hear a report from Scott Morgan, and then look at some of the key moments from Tuesday evening's one and only vice presidential debate. To round out the podcast, I bring you part of my interview with AP reporter and friend of the pod, Jeffrey Collins, who witnessed the first execution of a South Carolina inmate in 13 years nearly 2 weeks ago, and tell us how the state got there. The Lead loves hearing from everyone. As you can hear me, I have vehicles driving by me in the background. Let me know some of the favorite spots in South Carolina where you like to park on the side of the road and give people a shout. Yes, we're in the upstate, so if you're in Greenville, give us a shout, folks. I'm up here. Give us a shout, 803-563-7169. Say shout one more time. The deadline to register to vote via online is Sunday, October 6th at midnight. Go to scvotes.gov to register, find your sample ballot and your voting location, and so much more. scvotes.gov. Now, before we get into the vice presidential debate, I need to mention Tropical Storm Helene. Our state and region has been rocked by this storm, possibly the worst storm in our state's history, with some damage estimates pushing it past the state's notorious 1989 Hurricane Hugo, which made landfall in McClellanville as a Category 4 storm and made it to Charlotte as a Category 1. We have already seen more folks die from the storm, 36 as of this morning, than who were killed by Hugo. At the height of Helene, 1.3 million South Carolinians lost power, and 500,000 still don't have it almost a week later. That is due to substantial tree and power infrastructure damage from those tropical storm force winds, wind gusts, and possible tornadoes. So far, more than 1,500 homes have suffered damage and 66 have been completely destroyed. President Joe Biden is visiting the state today and will jump off from Greenville for an aerial tour of a decimated western North Carolina from Helene's torrential rains. We will have a fuller report for you on Saturday's podcast, but I wanted to bring you this report from Scott Morgan, who was on the ground in the upstate town of Landrum over the weekend.
On Sunday morning, if you shut your eyes, downtown Landrum would sound as normal as any September Sunday morning in this little city upstate. You can hear the traffic going up and down East Rutherford Street, the city's main business avenue. You can hear the leaf blowers and the crunchy leaves still settled on the sidewalk. But open your eyes and you start to notice what's going on. Every shop closed, and not because everyone's in church, but because everyone is in the dark. Landrum is a city of about 2,600 in Spartanburg County, very near the North Carolina border. And 2 days after Tropical Storm Helene blew through, Landrum is entirely without power. None for the traffic lights, none for the businesses, none for the gas stations, meaning residents can't fill up their vehicles or their generators, which they're relying on for any kind of power. Most energy customers around here are customers of Duke Energy, which dispatched 10,000 workers to various corners of South Carolina Friday, and which reported, as of noon Sunday, 151,000 power outages just in the Spartanburg area. And it's like this pretty much everywhere west of York County and stretching down the Midlands into Aiken County. By Sunday afternoon, the United States Power Outage Map reported hundreds of thousands of power outages in 29 South Carolina counties. Some, like Spartanburg, Greenwood, and Saluda counties, were almost entirely without power. In at least 8 counties, at least 8 in 10 energy customers of all providers were still without power by noon Sunday. The sound of a commercial generator drew me to walk down South Church Street, where time has essentially stopped. About 100 feet of fallen power lines and a piece of utility pole woven through the cables are down. Crews are working everywhere to clean scenes like this up in Landrum and everywhere else in the upstate, but they haven't gotten here yet. This is not as high priority as things like hospitals and emergency services and major roads blocked by fallen power lines and trees, so anyone looking to drive down South Church Street in Landrum will have to wait. The downed lines fell in front of Dakota Ayer's house. I meet him while I'm taking photos of the scene.
So all this happened early Friday morning. I guess that's when they said we were supposed to start getting the 60 to 70 mile per hour winds. And then I got out and started driving around lunch, and it was all about like this. The only way in the Landrum was 176. Coming this way, you couldn't get in down any of the side roads or anything like that. They were all blocked by trees and power lines.
Ayers owns this house that was, he's grateful, spared the worst of the storm. But he says he and his brother are still stunned by the scale of things.
And I'm 29, and my brother's in his 40s, and he said he's never seen anything like this come through here before.
Across the street from Ayers' house, multiple parts of what look like multiple trees are in a pile on a neighbor's property. Looming over us as we talk, a tall, broad oak tree towers just a few feet from Ayers' house, waving gently this morning as if nothing has happened around it. Ayers loves this tree. It brings him shade in the summer. But after seeing Helene's aftermath, he's definitely considering cutting it down.
Yeah, well, before this happened, I was wanting to cut some of these down, just some of the larger ones, but now for sure.
It's the trees that proved to be the deadliest aspects of Helene's wake. By Saturday evening, the death toll wrought by Helene in South Carolina hit 23, as confirmed by various county coroners and public safety officials. In Landrum, this small city of just over 2,600, three people died as the result of the storm. County Coroner Rusty Clevenger said that two of those were killed when a tree fell on a golf cart. The other was washed away in floodwaters.
You can find that in all of our reporting on SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. The one and only vice presidential debate took place Tuesday evening in New York. CBS News' Nora O'Donnell and Margaret Brennan moderated the 90-minute debate between Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Republican Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. The debate was incredibly cordial, some would say too cordial, and civil, with both men acting respectfully toward each other and the moderators. The debate covered international issues such as the growing Iranian threat, Hurricane Helene and climate change, the economy, immigration, abortion, guns, and healthcare. They were all being debated between the two as they defended their own records in office, as well as the two candidates on the top of the ticket. Now, I think the most interesting responses came after they were both asked about upholding election results, which came toward the end of the debate.
Donald Trump refused to acknowledge this. And the fact is that I don't think we can be the frog in the pot and let the boiling water go up. He was very clear. I mean, he lost this election and he said he didn't. 140 police officers were beaten at the Capitol that day, some with the American flag. Several later died. And it wasn't just in there. In Minnesota, a group gathered on the state Capitol grounds in St. Paul and said, "We're marching to the governor's residence and there may be casualties." The only person there was my son and his dog, who was rushed out crying by state police.
This has been going on for a long time. And if we want to say that we need to respect the results of the election, I'm on board. But if we want to say, as Tim Walz is saying, that this is just a problem that Republicans have had, I don't buy that.
January 6th was not Facebook ads. And I think a revisionist history on this. Look, I don't understand how we got to this point. But the issue was that happened. Donald Trump can do it. And all of us say there's no place for this. It has massive repercussions. This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer for you to not talk about censorship. Obviously, Donald Trump and I think that there were problems in 2020. We've talked about it. I'm happy to talk about it further.
I see a candidate out there who refused, and now again, and this, I'm pretty shocked by this, he lost the election. This is not a debate. It's not anything anywhere other than in Donald Trump's world. Because look, when Mike Pence made that decision to certify that election, that's why Mike Pence isn't on this stage. What I'm concerned about is, where is the firewall with Donald Trump? Where is the firewall if he knows he could do anything, including taking an election, and his vice president's not going to stand to it? That's what we're asking you, America. Will you stand up? Will you keep your oath of office even if the president doesn't?
That was definitely more of a pointed point of the night, and that is saying a lot. Yes, there's a lot of discussion here, a lot of policy stuff, no big zingers, but that's not a bad thing. This is what it's supposed to sound like. However, Vance did do what a lot of folks say Trump should have done during the first debate, and that was to blame Kamala Harris for not getting these policies passed during her time in office. Walls also made that point about Trump when the two were discussing immigration.
So first of all, Margaret, before we talk about deportations, we have to stop the bleeding. We have a historic immigration crisis because Kamala Harris started and said that she wanted to undo all of Donald Trump's border policies. 94 executive orders suspending deportations, decriminalizing illegal aliens, massively increasing the asylum fraud that exists in our system. That has opened the floodgates. And what it's meant is that a lot of fentanyl is coming into our country. I had a mother who struggled with opioid addiction and has gotten clean. I don't want people who are struggling with addiction to be deprived of their second chance because Kamala Harris let in fentanyl into our communities at record levels. So you've got to stop the bleeding. You've got to re-implement Donald Trump's border policies, build the wall, re-implement deportations. And that gets me to your point, Margaret, about what do we actually do? So we've got 20, 25 million illegal aliens who are here in the country. What do we do with them? I think the first thing that we do is we start with the criminal migrants. About a million of those people have committed some form of crime in addition to crossing the border illegally. I think you start with deportations on those folks. And then I think you make it harder for illegal aliens to undercut the wages of American workers. A lot of people will go home if they can't work for less than minimum wage in our own country. And by the way, that'll be really good for our workers who just want to earn a fair wage for doing a good day's work.
But let's go back to this on immigration. Kamala Harris was the attorney general of the largest state and a border state in California. She's the only person in this race who prosecuted transnational gangs for human trafficking and drug interventions. But look, we all want to solve this. Most of us want to solve this. And that is the United States Congress. That's the Border Patrol agents. That's the Chamber of Commerce. That's most Americans out here. That's why we had the fairest and the toughest bill on immigration that this nation's seen. We fixed this issue with a bill that is necessary. But the issue on this is what happens when you don't want to solve it. You demonize it. And we saw this. And Senator Vance, and it surprises me on this, talking about and saying, I will create stories to bring attention to this. That vilified a large number of people who were here legally in the community of Springfield. The Republican governor said, it's not true. Don't do it. There's consequences for this. There's consequences. We could come together. Senator Lankford did it. We could come together and solve this if we didn't let Donald Trump continue to make it an issue. And the consequences in Springfield were the governor had to send state law enforcement to escort kindergartners to school.
Now, Governor Waltz brought up the community of Springfield, and he's very worried about the things that I've said in Springfield. Look, in Springfield, Ohio, and in communities all across this country, you've got schools that are overwhelmed, you've got hospitals that are overwhelmed, you have got housing that is totally unaffordable because we brought in millions of illegal immigrants to compete with Americans for scarce homes. The people that I'm most worried about in Springfield, Ohio, are the American citizens who have had their lives destroyed by Kamala Harris's open border. It is a disgrace, Tim.
It is law enforcement that asked for the bill. They helped craft it. They're the ones that supported it. That's because they know we need to do this.
Just to clarify for our viewers, Springfield, Ohio does have a large number of Haitian migrants who have legal status. Right. Temporary protected status.
Well, Margaret, but
thank you, Senator. We have so much to get to.
Margaret, I think it's important
because we're going to turn out of the economy. Thank you,
Margaret. The rules were that you guys weren't going to fact check.
Something that Kamala Harris created, Margaret.
Gentlemen, the audience can't hear you because your mics are cut.
Minnesota, South Dakota, and Virginia began early voting on September 20th. A lot of folks in the swing states of North Carolina and Georgia did not have power, so they weren't able to catch this debate, but. Who's to say they would anyway? No offense. Though pundits debate just how much of an impact this one will have on the race, since both didn't really have any gaffes and kept all their hits above the belt. A big discussion was also over reproductive rights, which is an issue the Harris campaign is hoping to capitalize on this November.
He brags about how great it was that he put the judges in and overturned Roe versus Wade, 52 years of personal autonomy. And then he tells us, oh, we send it to the states. It's a beautiful thing. Amanda Zaworski would disagree with you on it's a beautiful thing. A young bride in Texas waiting for their child at 18 weeks, She has a complication, a tear in the membrane. She needs to go in. The medical care at that point needs to be decided by the doctor. And that would have been an abortion. But in Texas, that would have put them in legal jeopardy. She went home, got sepsis, nearly dies, and now she may have difficulty having children. Or in Kentucky, Hadley Duvall, a 12-year-old child, raped and impregnated by her stepfather. Those are horrific. Now, when got asked about that, Senator Vance said, two wrongs don't make a right. There is no right in this. So in Minnesota, what we did was restore Roe versus Wade. We made sure that we put women in charge of their health care. But look, this is not where, if you don't know Amanda or a Hadley, you soon will.
You know, I grew up in a working class family in a neighborhood where I knew a lot of young women who had unplanned pregnancies and decided to terminate those pregnancies because they feel like they didn't have any other options. And, you know, I one of them is actually very dear to me. And I know she's watching tonight, and I love you. And she told me something a couple years ago that she felt like if she hadn't had that abortion, that it would have destroyed her life because she was in an abusive relationship. And I think that what I take from that as a Republican who proudly wants to protect innocent life in this country, who proudly wants to protect the vulnerable, is that my party, we've got to do so much better of a job at earning the American people's trust back on this issue where they frankly just don't trust us. And I think that's one of the things that Donald Trump and I are endeavoring to do. I want us as a Republican Party to be pro-family in the fullest sense of the word. I want us to support fertility treatments.
When you listen to Vice President Harris talk about this subject and you hear me talk about it, you hear us talking exactly the same. Donald Trump is trying to figure out how to get the political right of this. I agree with a lot of what Senator Vance said about what's happening. His running mate, though, does not, and that's the problem.
I never supported a national ban. I did, during when I was running for Senate in 2022, talk about setting some minimum national standard. For example, we have a partial birth abortion ban in place in this country at the federal level. I don't think anybody's trying to get rid of that, or at least I hope not, though I know that Democrats have taken a very radical pro-abortion stance. But Nora, you know, one of the thing that's changed is in the state of Ohio, we had a referendum in 2023, and the people of Ohio voted overwhelmingly, by the way, against my position. And I think that what I learned from that, Nora, is that we've got to do a better job at winning back people's trust. So many young women would love to have families. So many young women also see an unplanned pregnancy as something that's going to destroy their livelihood, destroy their education, destroy their relationships. And we have got to earn people's trust back.
There was much more there too, but guys, like I said, I think we covered the highlights for you. You can always catch a lot more of that on some of your other favorite podcasts. I know we went a little national here, but hey, we're trying to keep you informed, cut through some of that noise, and give you more context ahead of November 5th. As you likely know by now, South Carolina has restarted executions after more than 13 years. The first one took place 2 weeks ago when convicted murderer Freddie Owens was put to death by lethal injection. Now that the state can acquire the needed drug through a shield law that blocks the identity of pharmaceutical providers. I spoke with Associated Press reporter Jeffrey Collins, who was one of three media witnesses looking in on the death chamber at Broad River Correctional Institution when Owens was executed on September 20th.
The Supreme Court rarely intervenes, especially in its current makeup. It's much harder to get them to come in what's typically a 6-3 court. On the governor's side of things, it's never happened before. South Carolina has executed 44 inmates since the death penalty restarted in 1976. No governor's granted clemency to any of them.
What were some of the key moments over the past 13 years to get us to this point from when lethal injection stopped back in 2011 to now Freddie Owens was put to death by lethal injection last Friday?
The last execution was in 2011, and it was a man who had voluntarily gave up some of his appeals. Mm. So that was part of it. Part of it was just because the ebb and flow of court cases, especially in the first few years after 2011, no one came up. And then by the time folks started to run out of appeals, inmates started to run out of appeals, Brian Sterling became corrections director. He had looked, you know, he kind of did an overview of the agency, looked at everything and discovered that the drugs that South Carolina, they used three drugs at the time, mm-hmm. some of them were out of date. And so, you know, they're expired. So he went to go look for new drugs. Well, by that point, the death penalty atmosphere, so to speak, had come around where companies no longer sold prisons death penalty drugs that could be used in the death penalty. So mm-hmm. once that happened, South Carolina couldn't buy it, and if the buyers were people they bought from were going to be made publicly known. Mm-hmm. So there was a fight for a few years to pass what's called the Shield Law that gives privacy to all sorts of areas of the death penalty, not just the, you know, who supplies the death penalty drugs, but the names of anyone involved in executions are kept secret. The exact method involved is kept secret. We don't know how much drug is put into the inmate. All that kind of thing is kept secret. That was a key component, along with a passage they tried to work the firing squad in to give a choice to inmates, but that didn't quite satisfy the court. So essentially, what it had to get up to the Shield Law point where the courts were satisfied, and we're at the point now where executions have restarted.
Mm-hmm. Was it shocking that it took 13 years? I mean, we talked to Brian Sterling about it over and over again, to get that Shield Law, which was so critical, after a bunch of other, you know, options were put into place, including making the electric chair the default option if lethal injection drugs weren't available, and then the firing squad like you're talking about.
The whole atmosphere around the death penalty has changed. You know, I started at the Associated Press about 25 years ago, and there were death penalty trials all the time. I mean, you know, South Carolina, after Freddie Owens was executed, has 31 inmates on death row. In 2011, double that. There were, I think there may have been like 62, 63, somewhere in there, inmates on death row. And it's not because people left because they're executed. A number of them had their death sentences reduced. Some died of natural causes. But in that same period of time, only three inmates have been sent to death row, have been convicted and sentenced to death and sent to death row. Hmm. And so, you know, part of that is, it's an atmosphere thing, I think, part of it. And part of it is, I think, just they do a better job. Defense attorneys do a better job of defending these clients. It used to be, you know, in Freddie Owens' case, he had a public defender and he had someone from the private bar who pro bono works with him. It happened to be Senator Carl Allen. I mean, now instead, when you come up for a death penalty trial, you have lawyers that are trained and do nothing but these very serious cases that are mm-hmm. going to be potentially capital cases. So they look at every nook and cranny of the case, and it becomes, you know, if you're a prosecutor, you have to have your case very buttoned up to even get to that point. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of a difference in how we look at the death penalty, I think, as a state to a certain extent.
And Jeffrey, you were one of the three media representatives there watching in on the death chamber during the execution. You've covered several executions in the past. Tell us about what happened there and then also what you observed, if it was any different than maybe what you've seen before.
The one key difference is it took longer. It seemed in my mind to take longer. I couch it a little bit because it was, you know, 13 years since I had seen one. So, I mean, you know, memories get a little hazy sometimes. But it seemed to take about twice as long as I recall to get to the point from which the execution starts to the point at which it looks like the inmate has stopped breathing. That seemed to, but as you call it, typical, yeah. I mean, I didn't see anything unusual. There was no obvious signs of distress mm-hmm. or discomfort or pain, but the death penalty is a hard thing to determine that, right? Because sure. I mean, how are we going to determine if the inmate feels pain? Well, you'd have to ask them, and you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to tell if there's anything like that happening. But yes, I mean, you know, there's always indications and signs. You know, there were, like I said, no grimacing, nothing like that. Mm-hmm. The, you know, Freddie Owens and his lawyer, longtime lawyer, they had some interaction back and forth. There's a glass window, so it was more trying to mouth things back to each other and make gestures. But they had some interaction. But yes, in general, it wasn't all that much different from the other eight I've seen, or the other seven lethal injections I've seen.
You can watch that full interview and more on youtube.com/SouthCarolinaETV. And folks, we have no wind down for you. We have so much going on, but we'll catch you up on Saturday. Thanks as always for listening. And of course, you can always stay up to date with the latest news on scetv.org and southcarolinapublicradio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina. Welcome to South Carolina Lead. This is Gavin Jackson coming to you from the side of the road.
Yeah, that's fine. You look good.